Tuesday night, and I had an interview. In fact, I got a phone call Tuesday saying, you know, would you be prepared to do a drive time interview in Hawking's new book? And I said, oh, drive time, sure, I can get a good audience in. Then they told me it was drive time London, UK. So that meant it would be 11:30 p.m. to about 1:30 a.m. So that's the other thing. It turned out to be a much longer interview than I anticipated. They had another physicist on the line, John Polkinghorne. He takes a fairly different perspective than we do. But it was fun interacting with him again because I'd been with him at Cambridge a number of years ago. What was interesting about that interview is the interviewer just says, look, Hawking claims that nothing makes something. How does he actually pull that off? And I've been told by people he does it through an analogy with virtual particle production. But while I was on the plane, I read every word of this book. So, and interestingly, on the flight back, the plane was filled with people reading this book. This has been on the best. By the way, this is now outselling all the novels on the bestseller list. So, but I think it's because of who the man is, Stephen Hawking. But what he really does is he takes you back to the very early history of the universe. Extremely early history, less than a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second after the cosmic creation event. And he says at that particular epoch, the sum total of the negative energy in the universe equals the sum total of the positive energy in the universe. And therefore he claims that since they're in equal balance, nothing can bifurcate into positive energy and negative energy, and that's where the universe comes from. So he's literally claiming that you begin with nothing and it produces something. And that's what I found throughout the whole book, is that he's consistently violating the principle of cause and effect, where he's claiming you can get much bigger effects from lesser causes. Everything in science tells us, philosophy and theology too for that matter, is that the effects are always lesser than the causes. So, but probably the thing that disturbed me most in this book, it's towards the end, I'll just read it to you verbatim. He says, the entire observable universe is only one of many. He basically appeals to the multiverse. And he admits that the multiverse is pure speculation. I mean, because of the fact that we're constrained to this universe, that God made three, we can only know one. In fact, Stephen Hawking's own space-time theorems establish that if God made two universes, once you get observers in universe A, the space-time envelope of that universe can never overlap the space-time envelope of any other possibly existing universe. So if God made a million universes, we would never know. If he made two universes, we would never know, because we can only know about the universe in which we live. And so that's the constraint of our knowledge. But the argument he makes in this book here is that if you look at, let me just read it, so and I'm not taking him out of context. It says, the entire universe is only one of many, just as our solar system is one of many. In the same way that the environmental coincidences of our solar system were rendered unremarkable by the realization that billions of such systems exist, the fine-tuning the laws of nature may be explained by the existence of multiple universes. Then he gives a second analogy. Just as Darwin and Wallace explained the apparently miraculous design of living forms could appear without intervention by a supreme being, the multiverse concept can explain the fine-tuning of physical law without the need for a benevolent creator. Now, my own journey to coming to the Christian faith was the exact opposite of this, in the sense that, looking at the origin of life, realizing this can't happen by natural process, you're going to need a supernatural intervention to explain it. You're going to need a supernatural intervention to get from the first life form to human beings. This can't happen by natural process. And if that can't happen by natural process, the universe can't happen by natural process. And likewise, as we look at all these extrasolar planets, the presumption back in 1995 when the first of these planets was discovered was that they would prove that all of our solar system planets were ordinary, very common. In fact, the 492 planets that have been discovered so far outside of their solar system, they're all radically different than the planets in our own solar system. It's proved the exact opposite. And so a question I got asked is, well, how come Stephen Hawking can make these kinds of really, gross category errors? Well, Stephen Hawking, I told a little story about the very first physics lecture I got at the University of British Columbia. The physics professor sat down with 600 of us freshman physics students and said, in the next 4 years, we're not only going to show you how to do physics better than anyone else can do physics, we're going to show you how to do anything better than anybody else can do. And so it's that kind of arrogance in physics, and I think I see it most predominantly in theoretical physics. And, of course, Stephen Hawking is a theoretical physicist. And so because he's a theoretical physicist, and because he's one of the world's renowned theoretical physicists, he thinks he has the ability to speak on any subject with more expertise than the people in those various disciplines. And he's not the first theoretical physicist I've met like that. I mean, they do have enormous IQs. They're very brilliant people. And they've been taught by their professors, just like I was, that they can do everything better than anybody else can do. So, but it also shows that what happens when you get into extreme specialization. I mean, he is the world's foremost expert on the theoretical physics that governs black holes. And he's written the best material I've seen on the physics of black holes. But he's an expert in that because of the way he's able to focus on that very narrow discipline. In fact, I heard Hawking give a lecture at Caltech where he basically said, there's 300 of us in the audience. And he says, you all think I'm incredibly brilliant. And he says, it's not that I'm more brilliant than the rest of you. It's that I'm not distracted. Because of my handicap, the only thing I can do is theoretical physics. I can't play golf like the rest of you. He says, all I can do is theoretical physics. And because I can focus like that, I'm able to make certain achievements of a certain significance. The other thing you need to take into account is I think he's guided by his desire, as he's expressed in many of his previous books, to come up with a theory of everything. A theory of physics that would answer all the questions we would have about the universe and about everything else in existence. And he describes that theory of everything, not just a theory that explains and unifies the forces of physics and explains how all physics ties together. It would be a theory that would give us the answers to everything, even questions pertaining to free will and predestination. He says, if we come up with this theory of everything, then we will know the mind of God. We'll know as much as God knows. And so I think that is also guiding him. He's chosen the one model of the universe, M-theory, and the multiverse, which would actually permit the possibility of a human being, quote, knowing everything. But the realistic models of the universe tell us that we human beings will never know everything. That we are indeed constrained by the space-time dimensions of the universe. And it was the German philosopher Goethe who proved years ago that if you are constrained to a system and can't get outside of it, then it's impossible to get complete knowledge of that system, which means we'll never have the mind of God. And for what it's worth, when we go to the new creation as followers of Jesus Christ, we still won't have the mind of God. We'll never have the mind of God. That's not going to happen. And there was an individual who popped into the Garden of Eden in chapter 3 who tried to deceive Adam and Eve that they could know as much as God knows. And that lie is still being propagated to this very day in the halls of our highest educational institutions. But it also underlies the fact that we need to integrate. I mean, because of the advance of technology today, in order to advance your discipline, you have to specialize. I told the joke last week. When we Caltech astronomers would go over to the Burger Continental for lunch, you had to be careful which table you sat at. Because if you sat at the table it was not in your specific narrow discipline, you could not follow the conversation. We literally had a table for the X-ray astronomers, one for the ultraviolet astronomers, the infrared astronomers. I was at the high-frequency radio astronomy table. We had also the low-frequency radio astronomy table. And that's how you advance the field. However, in order to answer these kinds of grand design questions, the book is called The Grand Design, or the questions, why are we here? what is there beyond the universe? Those kinds of questions require integration, integrate across all the scientific disciplines. And of course, nobody's going to know everything in all those disciplines, but you know a little bit. That's basically what we're trying to do in this class, help you integrate the 66 books of the Bible, help you integrate across the scientific disciplines. And it's no guarantee that you'll come up with the truth. I would argue it's a better pathway than just simply looking at the one narrow discipline. By the way, I'm all in favor of Bible study classes where you study in depth the book of Ephesians. But there is a time when you want to integrate what Paul is saying in Ephesians with what he is saying in Romans, with what he is saying in Thessalonians. For that matter, you want to look at what Peter is saying and James is saying and the author of the book of Hebrews is saying, kind of integrate that all together. So that's kind of the focus of this class. But it was really fun doing the interview. I had to learn the British accent, so... And one of the accents was pretty extreme, but they thought my accent was extreme, so. Yes.
To me, it's significant, if I understand it, that he doesn't start at point zero in time, but he starts at some point after that, however infinitesimal, in which the laws of physics already exist. And he doesn't start with nothing, he starts with a given.
Well, to be fair to Stephen Hawking, he's not saying that God is not necessary to set up the mathematics and the equations of physics. But what he is saying is once the math is in place and the laws of physics are in place, then God can take a 14 billion year vacation. He's not necessary once the math and physics is set up, which is why he argues that God is not personal. But he's got the problem now. How do you get personal beings coming from a creator that's not personal himself and coming from a universe that has no personality? Or even more challenging, how do you explain the existence of souls? How do you explain spiritual beings, which are not physical at all, coming from that which is purely physical? So again, you got the cause and effect problem. But what he actually argues for in this book, he's arguing for a radical change in the principle of causality. So he does realize that if you go along with his proposal for the grand design, you have to abandon the traditional law of causality, that effects come after causes, and effects are never greater than their causes. But that's actually asking for a complete overturn of the way science is done. So, but at least he's acknowledging that that's what he's actually calling people to consider, is that we have to abandon the law of causality and come up with a different law of causality. In fact, the law of causality he's arguing for is one where we human beings, by our power of observation, influence events that took place before we were born. So, yeah. I mean, if you read this, there's some real shockers that come out to you. And by the way, the book is not that hard to read as long as you're prepared to deal with the contradictions that pop up throughout the book. People told me it's difficult to read. It's because they're expecting the book to be consistent and coherent. It's definitely not coherent, and it's not consistent. But if you just kind of put that aside and look for the statements, you can figure out what's going on. In the back. Well, he's arguing for a completely different picture of design. In fact, he begins, the opening page of the book basically says, philosophy is dead. Theoretical physics has replaced philosophy. Theoretical physics has replaced theology. And, you know, philosophers and theologians need to be put on the welfare rolls. And let's just move on. So, I mean, Ken Samples, when he picked this up, said, you know, I've never found a book more offensive to read in my... I says, well, Ken, just forget the introduction and move on. By the way, one thing I will commend this book for, and it may be more the property of Leonard Mlodinow, his co-author, is that the first four chapters do give you a good introduction to kind of the history and the flow of science over the past 2,500 years. That's worth reading. It's got lots of nice pictures and diagrams that will help you. But then the last two chapters get highly philosophical. So he says philosophy is dead, but the last two chapters are basically nothing but philosophy. come to you, then back to you. Yeah, go ahead.
It seems to me he's gone onto a slippery slope. He's moved from strict materialism to deism. That's the same thing C.S. Lewis did.
Well, I think Hawking has always been a deist. What's different now is that in his deism, he is insistent that God cannot possibly be a personal being, and there's no personality behind the physics or the mathematics, the universe, or our own existence. You know, somehow he believes that equations of physics are all you need to make human beings.
I think he's flailing. You know, he's on this slippery slope, Eddie. That's why he's alive still.
Well, there are a lot of Christians in his life. Throughout his whole life, there have been a lot of Christians. But the thing he's been resolute about is that he does not want a being having authority over his life. Well, it's what I've said about atheists in the past, is that, in one sense, their atheism itself betrays the existence of God. I mean, if God really doesn't exist, you'd be treating God like the Easter Bunny or Santa Claus. But they don't. There's a passion here. He's always writing about God. He's been doing that for the past 40 years. And it's like what I told the atheists at the Skeptic Society a couple of years ago, is that it's not that you don't believe in God, it's that you don't like him. You don't want him ruling over you. It's what the religious leaders said to Jesus, we will not have this man rule over us. And so that's kind of the fundamental problem of every human being. We want to be autonomous. We do not want to submit to a higher authority telling us what to do and how to run our lives. In fact, my crisis of faith in reading through a Gideon Bible at age 19 was coming to the recognition the creator of the universe knows better than I do what's best for me. And it's only rational for me to submit my life to him because he's in a much better position to direct my life and to guide me along than my own feeble attempts. But a lot of people aren't there yet. And I'm glad you say yet, because you know, he is still alive. There's Christians in his life. There's still hope. Come back to you, and then Al, you're next.
Yeah. I watched him on Larry King. Why?
Yeah.
That interview, and if I understood him correctly, I didn't hear a hint of deism. What I heard was atheism. We don't need God. Now, his co-author was not atheistic or even agnostic. He said that the whole discussion is irrelevant. It's just this is separate and it's adequate.
Yeah, well, I think Hawking would concur with that if there's a God out there, we don't have to pay attention to him, because once that God sets up the mathematics, we don't need him anymore. And I think he's ambivalent on it. He says, whether or not he does realize we need the math and the physics, and that's got to come from something or somewhere. So he says, call it God if you want. But see, the problem is when you put the word God on it, that implies to the vast majority of the world's population a personal being, and he's adamant that such a being doesn't exist, which I think explains his reluctance to, quote, call the cause or the origin of the math and the physics God, because he realizes what that means to most people. But yeah, I would argue that Leonard is a little more ambivalent on that. Al, you're next, and we'll come to you. Go ahead.
So that's one thing. The other thing is this thing of you come out of nothing to something. There's particles that appear and then disappear in the universe, right?
True, but they don't come from nothing. They come from the quantum space-time foam. And quantum space-time foam is something. Keep in mind, when the universe was at its very origin, it was empty of matter and it was empty of what we would call photonic energy. All the universe had at its beginning was highly compressed space curvature, but it's that release of space curvature that produced the photons and later produced the matter. So a quantum space-time foam is not nothing. But what I'm reading in this book is he uses that as an analogy. What he's basically saying is that you've got equal amounts of positive and negative energy, at least at one epoch in the universe. And could it be the beginning? Maybe. Is it after the beginning? We don't know. to really get an answer to when the universe had equal amounts of positive and negative energy, you would need a particle accelerator 40 trillion miles long. So not likely to be funded even with... I won't go there. Well, let me give you some background on, because I actually know what was going on. You know, he got his Lou Gehrig's disease when he was in his early 20s. And when he got the disease, he basically became a drunkard. Was very despondent, incredible despair. But then he met Jane. And Jane was the one who said, look, all right, you've got this disease. You've been told you're going to die in less than 2 years. Do something with your last few months of your life. Why are you just drinking yourself to death? God's given you a mind. Your body may be decaying, but the thing about Lou Gehrig's disease, the mind remains intact to the very end. The mind does not decay. And she basically challenged him. Now, she was a believer. She was the one that prayed for him. He didn't pray. She prayed. And the disease halted. And so he reached a certain point. Then he realized, you know what? The disease isn't advancing. And that's when he began to really apply himself to finishing his doctoral studies at Cambridge. And the disease remained in that dormant state for many decades thereafter. He's undergoing a little bit of decline now, but after all, he's 68. So he's done well. And by the way, that does happen in very rare situations with ALS. But it's extremely rare. But he credits his wife, Jane, for praying and bringing about the halt to that disease. So then, years later, he divorced her. But I hear his current wife is regularly attending a Baptist church. So, yes.
Okay, God created the universe, correct?
Yes.
And he created Adam out of dust, out of the earth.
Part of Adam out of the dust. No, it says he took something from her side. I mean, based on what I see described there in Genesis 2, I believe it's God taking a biopsy from the body of Adam. And see, any biopsy would give you the DNA template of Adam. And you only have to make certain adjustments to that DNA template to get the woman. So it's an efficient way to make the woman from, quote, the side of Adam. But just to complete it, he made Adam from the dust of the earth, but he created in Adam something that never existed before. So if you read the biblical text in the original Hebrew, it uses the verbs asah and bara for God pulling together Adam. Asah means he manufactured. That's the term that's used when God picks up the dust of the earth and puts together the shape of the body of Adam. He's taking components that already exist and personally manufacturing it into this physical being. But then he places something with an Adam that never existed before in the history of the universe, and that's the spirit. Human beings are the only spirit species that exists on the face of the earth. And so that's why you see that Hebrew word bara, it's the same word that the biblical text uses for God creating the universe. So he created the universe out of that which did not exist before. Well, the Bible doesn't use the word species. It uses the word min, which means kind. But it's basically referring to creatures that reproduce after their own kind. And, you know, a lot of people have been asking us, okay, exactly how do you relate species to min? Well, it's difficult because in the scientific literature, there are 16 different definitions for species. And, you know, some of them are so narrow that you would call different breeds of dogs independent species. And others are quite so broad that you would actually identify them with an entire genus. So that's the range of definitions.
I just want to make sure I understand this. I mean, each animal, each fish, each type of bird, whatever, originally,
That's something we saw when we studied Psalm 104, that God takes credit for every kind of life that has ever existed on the face of the earth. Now, there are about 500 million species of life that we can document in the fossil record having existed, somewhere between 500 million and 1 billion. And we know that the definition for men, at least for the higher animals, must be quite narrow, because in the book of Deuteronomy, it lists 6 different kinds of owls as separate men. So that would be fairly similar to our definition for different species of owls. But it makes no such comparison for bacteria, for the insects, so we really don't know how the Bible would define different men at that level. Right, right.
They reproduce from that point.
Right.
So God is all knowing, omnipotent, everything. That too.
Yeah, that too.
So he can basically do, I want to understand this, so he can basically do anything he wants.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Ah, with a few exceptions. He can't lie, he can't deceive, he can't do anything immoral. Yeah, I had one of those.
And you type. And then you don't like what you type, so you take the paper out, you scrunch it all up, and you throw it in the back.
Right, right.
Can God, let's say God decides now, sort of like the flood thing, but let's just say God decides, I don't like what this universe will become. I don't like, I'm going to destroy it and create something else. I mean, could he do this?
Yes. We studied that in Psalm 104 as well.
No, I mean now.
Now? No, because this is the day of God's rest. So God is not intervening like that during the day of his rest. For 6 days he creates, on the 7th day he rests.
When did his days of rest start?
His day of rest started when he completed the creation of Eve. So Eve was the last of God's physical creation miracles in this universe. Now, when it says God rests on the 7th day, it doesn't mean he's inactive. It simply means he ceases from his work of physical creation miracles. And you know, when we honor the Sabbath, it's the same way. We cease from our employment, but we feed our children. And you know, we go to church, we meditate. I mean, it's a time to stop certain activities so you can focus on other activities. And the 7th day, as the Bible explains, is that period of time when God brings about the end of all evil and suffering. Okay. Yeah, all right. Looks good.
So now, did God not part the Red Sea? Did he not have manna or bread
right.
from the heavens to feed the Jews escaping?
Right.
Yet, in the Holocaust, the 6 million Jews died, so he wasn't there then.
But yes, he was.
Was he?
Yeah, read about it in Ezekiel 37.
Right. But he was, but you're saying he rested after Eve, or Adam and Eve.
Right. Of course. But see, none of that's got anything to do with his physical creation miracle. He has not been creating new species of life, or more correctly, new kinds of life, since he created Eve.
He could still destroy the universe now if he wanted to.
Oh, yeah, he could. And he will. The 7th day ends when God speaks the universe out of existence. So, yeah, he will remove the universe from existence, but only after he permanently conquers and removes evil and suffering.
And I have to go?
No. The primary reason God created human beings is so that God could use humanity as a tool to bring about the end of all evil and suffering. So we're on center stage. That's what Paul says in Corinthians. He says the angels are watching us because they realize we are on the playing field of the grand scheme of God's creation. The angels are in the stands watching us. But we're the ones who are on the playing field trying to get a touchdown.
It almost seems like it's a chess game.
Yes, it is.
God's here, and I don't know if it's the devil or whatever. God's here, and somebody else is there. God's going to move this over here. Somebody, and it's just...
That's exactly right.
Really?
Yeah. You did, yeah.
Wow. Could that mean that I But then, anyway, so see, that's what I have trouble with. Is that the, I have the silliest question ever. But if you say that God can do whatever He wants, I mean, can He turn me into Bugs Bunny? I mean, I know that's a ridiculous question, but my meaning behind it is, He does those things. He had bread coming from the heaven to feed the Jews. He had certain miracles happening. So what's to prevent him from just doing crazy things? To do what? In other words,
what's his purpose?
What's his purpose? What's his theme? His plan? I mean,
okay. His ultimate? No. He created in order to express His love. And His goal is that the creatures that He created would be able to grow and expand in their ability to receive love and express love. Now, because of the situation we're in right now, where we have evil and suffering and decay and the laws of physics and the space-time dimensions, our free will is limited. And our capacity to express and receive love is very limited. But when God conquers and removes evil and suffering, He will then deliver us into a new creation where it has very different dimensions, very different laws of physics, and that's what's going to liberate our free will. So there's a lot of things that you can't do, even if you want to do them right now. I mean, all of us experience that, right? All kinds of things you want to do that you simply can't do because you're constrained by the physics of the universe. There will come a time when those constraints will be lifted. But not until evil is conquered and removed. Why? Those laws of physics and those space-time dimensions were optimally designed by God to bring about a restraint of the expression of evil on the part of human beings and to motivate us to pursue a path of virtue and to receive help from God to be delivered from that evil. And so as long as evil exists, those laws of physics must stay intact. Oh, God existed.
Well, God. No, God existed.
Right.
So, God has existed for infinity. I mean, there's no beginning. He's always there. So, at one point, you just decide, all right, it's time I create a universe or something. Because there's nothing. I mean, what was God doing during that nothing period? Was it just...
Well, that's a good question. The angels may have existed before the universe. We don't know whether the universe came before or after the angels. The one verse you have is Job 38:7, which says the angels were witnesses to God laying down the foundations of the earth. So they've been around for at least 4 or 5 billion years. It's possible they were around even before the universe existed. It's possible that the fall of Satan and the third of the angels that rebelled with Satan took place before the creation of the universe. There's a whole branch of Christian theology that argues that way and says God created the universe and later human beings in response to what happened in the angelic realm. There's another school of Christian theology which says, well, God knows the future. He foreknows and He predestinates and He knew ahead of time that this would happen with the angels. And so even though He created the angels only 5 billion years ago and the universe 14 billion years ago, knowing exactly what would happen in the future, He pre-designed the universe so that when this event happened in the angelic realm, everything would be perfectly set in place to deal with that very situation. And likewise, He brought us human beings on at the ideal time to deal with that situation. Now, all that presumes that God hasn't created anything besides this universe, human beings, and the angelic realm. We don't know that. There may be a whole lot more that God has done that we have no knowledge of. Evidently, all God has given us in this book, the Bible, is just enough information so that we human beings can follow through on what we need to do. We don't have to know everything. It's kind of like a general talking to his troops. He doesn't have to give them the battle plan. He simply gives them the orders. And likewise, when the orders are passed down from the general to the colonel doesn't have to tell the captain as much as he knows, just enough so that they can follow their orders. Well, I personally believe that there's a lot more that God has done that we won't know about until after evil is conquered and removed. And even then, we're not going to know everything. And moreover, the new creation may not be the end. Maybe God's going to do some stuff after he creates a new creation. In fact, there's a verse in Revelation that indicates in the new creation, God's going to be creating new forms of life. And that we'll be ruling over those new life forms that God creates. And, you know, based on our experience and training, we'll be effective in that role. It also tells us that because of the experience we're going through here in the universe, we will actually be elevated to a higher position, the angels, and we'll be training and leading the angels themselves. So it says right now we're lower than the angels. But we're on the playing field. The angels are in the stands watching. Because we're on the playing field, we have the opportunity to be equipped and trained to do something the angels can't do.
How do we know that? The angels are invisible.
Not always. The book of Hebrews, chapter 13.
You see a lot of them.
Yeah, but also there's a verse in Hebrews that tells us that many of you have entertained angels completely unaware. Now, most of us haven't, but...
That's what I'm saying. You've never seen them.
Maybe you're an angel.
Well, well, I know I'm not an angel, okay? I know my sons aren't angels, okay? However, no. Angels, unlike us, have the power to leave their realm and enter our realm. We human beings can't do that. We cannot enter the angelic realm. We're stuck here in this universe until we finish our life. But the angels can come and go. And they can come into our realm and they can take physical form, any physical form they want. So for example, you'll find a book over there on UFOs. I make the case in that book that there are angels that can take the form of spacecraft, balloons, dirigibles, leprechauns, whatever. I mean, they can take whatever form they want, including a human form. And so, for example, you read in this book how Abraham entertained angels and fed them. Likewise, Lot took two angels into his home. He wasn't aware who the angels were right away, but they took such physical form, he confused them for human beings. As it says at the beginning of the book of Hebrews, there's a vast host of angels out there that are ministering spirits to assist the ministry of us human beings. And maybe I could segue into our lesson right now. That might be good. That's an introduction. Because as we see here in Psalm 139. Let me just read this and then we'll do the abrupt segue I was in trying to get across here. O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, O Lord. You hem me in, behind and before. You have laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise in the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. That's the first 10 verses, then drop down to verse 16.
Where is free will?
Good question. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. Yeah, you're right. This Psalm 139 is basically making a declaration. Everything that happens in your life has been preordained. I can go to other passages which make the point they were preordained before God created the universe. 14 billion years ago or much earlier than that, God had preordained everything that was going to happen in your life. He is in complete control. But he's able to do that without removing your free will. It's free will, human free will and divine predestination. Okay, you should have been here 20 years ago. We spent a whole year going through that problem of free will and predestination. And if you missed out on that, the third edition of Beyond the Cosmos is sitting right over there. You can check that out. Yeah, you need to read it. And by the way, pardon me? I'm going to give it to him for free, not for you.
there are 6 billion people on this planet. Are you saying some of those 6 billion are the actual angels in human form?
Angels come and go. It's not that they permanently remain here. We never see an incident of an angel permanently remaining here on the earth. But they'll come for a few minutes, a few hours, and then they depart. Yeah. Same way that Jesus did. Where, you know, here were the disciples in the upper room with the doors and windows locked, and Jesus appeared among them, and then he disappeared. Now, well, he is called the angel of the Lord. And so, because God the Father is spirit. God the Father does not have a body. The Holy Spirit doesn't have a body. What it tells us in Colossians is that the second person of the Trinity, the creator of the universe, Jesus of Nazareth, the Messiah, is the fullness of the deity in bodily form. And so he can appear in bodily form any time he wants. You see instances of that in the Old Testament. There's a story in the Old Testament of Abraham giving food to the creator of the universe. And the creator of the universe was in physical form and partook of the food. So, that was the second person of the Trinity. And likewise, you know, he appeared in physical form in the incarnation. And that's why he's referred to as the angel of the Lord. Because just like angels can come from this spirit realm and appear in physical form, likewise, the second person of the Trinity can do that as well.
I keep trying to prove you're wrong, but I'm losing. I can't see you. I think I have a question that I got it.
But you know what? You're asking the right questions. Those are great questions you're putting forward. And see, these are the questions that David wrestled with. I mean, David is referred to as a man that was after God's own heart. Why? Because he pursued the questions with utmost enthusiasm and fervor and never let go. And, you know, he's a child of Jacob. Jacob wrestled with God. Now, he didn't physically wrestle with God, but he went to God in prayer, prayed all night long, and said, I need an answer. And he wouldn't stop praying until he got the answer. Well, I wanted to segue to a couple of stories about that. So, because somebody was asking me, have I ever seen an angel? I think I've experienced angels, personally. Because I can't explain what happened any other way. Not that I ever saw them. See, angels don't always have to appear in physical form. They can come into your realm of experience and assist you in your ministry and leave without anybody ever seeing them. But it's like things are happening that you realize if it wasn't for some kind of supernatural intervention, there's no way I would have gotten through this. So, and this is what King David experienced. He experienced, as we've been studying in 1 Samuel, many miraculous interventions on the part of God, whether it was God himself intervening or sending one of his angels. But that's the theme of Hebrews chapter 1, that there's this host of angels that are servants to those that are called to serve God. In other words, there are ministering servants sent by God to assist us who are followers of Jesus Christ to fulfill our ministry. And we've been giving lots of testimonies in this class of how we've been saved from certain death by what had to be God's direct miraculous intervention. I want to segue to examples where God was intervening to supernaturally assist us in a particular ministry. I got a few stories from my own life, but I bet you there's many of you here that got stories too. And I'm running out of time. There's no way I'm going to get to this today. But how about, and by the way, I don't think I'm here next Sunday. Somebody know my schedule? I don't know my own schedule. I'm not here? Okay.
No.
But next time I'm back here, I'm going to be in North Carolina at an apologetics conference. So, but I thought I was going to be back Sunday, but probably not, based on what you must know about my schedule. So, yeah, that's the only way I can survive. I mean, I was in Reading this week. If I start looking ahead to what I got to do, then I start confusing what I'm supposed to do in Reading and what I'm going to be doing in North Carolina or Austin. So I just try to take them one at a time. So come tomorrow morning, I'll look at my schedule and see what's going on in North Carolina. But yeah, I'd like all of us to, I'm going to launch off with a couple of just quick stories from my own experience. But my whole goal is to stimulate you to think like David thought and realize I'm able to do this because of God's intervention. He saved me so I can do this. And we also talked about how God brings death in very supernatural ways. So, and incidentally, I know some of you have still got stories of how God extended your life or how God brought death in a supernatural way to achieve God's purpose in your life and the life of those around you. I'm not going to put a stop on that because I know there's a couple of dynamite stories I still want to hear from people in the class. But then I'd like to move into how God intervenes to assist us in a particular ministry situation, just like he did for King David. So that's where we're going to go. And there was a question here I've been ignoring for a long time. Was it you, Al? I thought it was someone else. No, here we go. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to say that other philosophers and brilliant folk have said that evil and suffering bring forth the characters of virtue in people. Mercy, forgiveness, long-suffering, contemplation of the universe. Your body disintegrates like Hawking, and like Al said, well, no doubt he prayed and had to think a lot. If he didn't have that disease, he wouldn't be thinking and considering these things. If you were walking on a rose bed every day and everything was hunky-dory, you'd never contemplate anything.
Well, it's actually true as Stephen Hawking. He was failing his courses, even though he was very brilliant. Because there's only certain parts of the courses he was taking that interested him, and it took the disease to get him straightened out on a scholastic path. In fact, he's told audiences, if it wasn't for my disease, I wouldn't be where I am today. So he didn't give God the credit for it, but he basically said that I'm grateful for my disease because it's what has enabled me to do. And you're right. I mean, there are real benefits to the suffering that all of us experience. There's real benefits to the evil that comes into our life. It's a training experience. The angels don't get to participate in that. We do. And as I argued in Why the Universe is the Way It Is, it's kind of like taking a really stiff college course. You suffer when you take a hard course. I've had professors that really seem to take great relish in making us suffer to rather extreme degrees. But there's a benefit in that suffering. And years later, you look back and say, that was a really tough professor. But boy, did I learn a lot in that course. And today, I'm grateful for the fact. But I remember at the University of Toronto, they forced me to take a class way outside my discipline. And I was the only student in the entire astronomy department that was forced to do that. I complained. But to this day, I realize I'm really glad I took that course. It prepared me for an aspect of my Christian ministry that I never anticipated at the time.
What was the course?
It wasn't ceramics.
Contouring?
No. It was a course in solid-state physics. So, yeah, last, and then we got to close. Yep.
And then he has how angels, how Satan came, how hell came to be. And God is up there, you probably read it. He's up there in heaven. I hope it's not like what's an evangelist's name that said heaven was 1,300 feet long, miles wide, and 13
Oh, that's just the New Jerusalem. That's just a very tiny part of the new creation.
You said that was the way heaven was, and we sit around the fireplace and have angels wait on them. Anyhow, the thing is...
How about singing Kumbaya and playing harps, I mean?
but in the book, he says there's God up there, and the Son, Jesus, and the Holy Ghost, and they're all just laying around, I guess. I don't know. It doesn't describe what they're doing. And all these angels are around them, and the angels all of a sudden decide that one of them wants to be as powerful as God. And so he gets a big angel around him, and he gets him into having a big revolt. I mean, we think heaven is a peaceful place where he's going to go around and lay around. No, we have a war there, right? The bad angels, Lucifer, decide to have a war.
because he wants to be as powerful as God. And God says, well, you know, tells Jesus to and Archangel to go and have a big battle. There's a big battle in heaven. Here we are in heaven, having battle, having envy and, you know, the whole range probably of human things.
Yeah, sin's not limited to this universe.
And then he says, well, what am I going to do? And of course he wins. And then he says, what am I going to do with all the bad angels and Lucifer? Well, creates hell. And then after he creates hell, he says, now what am I going to do with hell? I got to have something to do with hell. So he creates humans.
Quick question.
how does anybody know what's happening in heaven? It's all,
okay. We don't know everything that's going on in heaven, but we do know a little bit.
And the writers of the Bible.
Okay. Milton got a few things right, but he got a lot of things wrong. What you need to do is read this book and figure out what he got right and what he got wrong. I think it'd be very edifying. So, but yeah, he was. But you know, none of us are perfect in our interpretation. You know, one thing I'm telling my boys, you know, you can't just ride on the spiritual coattails of your mom and me. You need to look at what we've taught you and realize, okay, they're human. Some of the things we've been taught aren't right. Some of the things are right. Figure out what it is. And then chart your own path, see what you can learn. Yeah, good advice. So check out this book, especially the last book, the Book of Revelation.
Yeah.
Well, you know what you can do? We have an MP3 series you can buy here, which actually gives you our entire 7.5-year course that we taught here in the Book of Revelation. You'll learn a lot about the kind of questions you're asking just by going through that. You can do that while you're stuck in freeway traffic. So, good place. All right, let's bow. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for these many years we've had going through this book. And Lord, there's so much more to learn. Thank you for giving us a book that can't be exhausted, that every time we go through it, there's new gems, new discoveries, new insights. But, Father, as we come up with these new truths from your word, I pray, Father, that you give us the humility to seek the application that you're asking us to bring into our own lives. Help us to submit to your truth. Help us to follow the direction that you're giving us through the revelation in your word. And not only just the words that you give us in the Bible, Father, but also your words spoken through the record of nature. Lord, I pray you make each one of us a better theologian, a more complete theologian, but a better and more complete scientist. And give us the humility of heart to listen to you and then to obey you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you. Oh, everybody who can stick around, talk about Skeptics Forum.